Hey everyone, it's your host with the most ghosts, Julian. And today on the Clear Cash podcast, me and Nick discuss the recent purchase of Humble Bundle by IGN and then spend about a half hour reminiscing about the Dreamcast and why the Dreamcast was so cool. We drop some facts, we drop some tidbits, some little tiddlywinks of information, fun stuff to know. The Dreamcast was great. We love it. Do you love it? I don't know. Let us know. Enjoy the episode. Is that the sound the ghosts make when they give shout-outs?
When I was in second grade, we were doing an exercise to practice our handwriting. Maybe it's probably first grade. Mm-hmm. And the prompt for the sentence that we had to write was, what do you like about Halloween? And my sentence was, in October, I like ghosts. And then it was one of those pieces of paper that has for little kids, that's got the lines on the bottom and then a big space at the top
to draw a picture. Your picture. Yeah.
So I drew a ghost wailing on a neon electric guitar.
Oh, no.
A flying V.
Yes. Was it the sheet ghost? The classic
sheet. Yeah. It's classic sheet. Yeah, for sure.
Did he have arms or was the guitar kind of just floating in front of him?
It's just floating in front of him and he's just full 500 thread count.
I love it.
Yeah, it was real cute. Where did that start,
do you think? I mean, if you trace back where the whole ghost image came from, was that a Scooby-Doo mm-hmm. thing with the sheet, or did that start way before?
Way precedes Scooby-Doo.
I tell you, that's the first place I remember seeing the classic sheet ghost was on an old Scooby-Doo episode.
No, it preceded Scooby-Doo by a long time, because there's that one Scooby-Doo episode where they go into the 1920s.
And there's a sheet ghost there.
There's a sheet ghost there, yeah.
Because that they had to go back in time to make that episode into the 1920s.
I don't know why you're being difficult.
Hey, I'm just trying to get my facts straight, because I'm not even sure about the whole sheet ghost thing. Because I can imagine Teddy Roosevelt in 1886 or something. At the mm-hmm. White House, which is famously haunted by sheet ghosts. Maybe he was the one who first saw it. I don't know.
Maybe it's like that movie Lake Mungo, which nobody has ever fucking seen.
Yeah, that's going deep to somewhere. I'm not even sure where.
I'm just saying, if Teddy Roosevelt is from 1886, maybe he's seeing his own fucking ghost. Because
was he dead by then?
No, I don't think he was born by then.
Who am I thinking of?
Some other president.
Fuck.
Oh yeah, I gotta look this up now. Am I stupid?
All right, let's.
Teddy Roosevelt. 1901 was his presidential term. He was alive in 1886.
Okay, so I'm a little. I undersold the presidency term, but I did nail that he was alive.
You know what? You didn't in fact even say he was president, did you?
So maybe I said he was in the White House.
Okay, maybe he was on a tour.
Yeah, he was on a tour. It was the catalyst for wanting to become the president, is he was there at the White House, saw a spooky ghost
of Christmas Future.
Yes, that's why he is there, is the Ghost of Christmas Future.
There you go.
So that's the beginning, I guess. Ebenezer Scrooge created the sheet ghost. That's fact story. Write it down. Yeah, so
Ebenezer Scrooge, Christmas Carol, that's that one author.
Origin stories.
Right, Charles, very long
Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens, thank you.
Yeah, Dickens, my boy. So here we are mm-hmm. in the throes of Octo. And things are heating up. Things are getting scary.
Mm-hmm. I once had a neighbor who was a young boy by the age of 8. And my partner and I were entering our building. And he was outside playing. And we'd say, hey, what's up, man? As we normally do. And he just stopped where he stood and turned to us and said, except have a scary.
Oh no.
We were like, no, nah, man, September's cool. Don't worry about September.
September and November, all good.
They're fine.
It's the one in between you got to worry about.
Yeah.
Always look behind your back.
I didn't give him a warning, though. I should have. I regret that.
Well, today's topic is the Dreamcast, which is not a spooky by nature.
No.
Did it come out in October? Do we know the...
It was, in fact, a September release.
Okay,
so September was awesome.
Yeah.
In 1999.
Yeah.
Not scary.
But before we get to that, there's one thing we wanted to cover, and that is the Humble Bundle being acquired by IGN.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, very weird. And, I mean, we both, you more than me, have used Humble Bundle. Are you subscribed to them?
I you know what? Let me cancel that subscription right now.
Oh, sure.
Yes, I am. I have like 100 games through that service. Oh, no, I have more than that because the bundles are so big.
Right.
And I probably bought like 10 of them. And then they're also just a good storefront. They have a bunch of, you know, good games.
Yeah, it's great. I think I've gotten a few bundles over the past couple of years. I think I got a Sid Meier's one once.
Yeah.
It's really great. Humble Bundle, essentially, if you don't know, is a service that supports charity in which more often than not, I think you would say that it's by a single developer will release a catalog of their games or a theme. More often than not, it's usually just a single developer, right?
No, actually,
no.
The original Humble Bundle and the model that still persists today is a theme, like you said. Or actually, the original model had no theme at all. It was just a collection of
just
games.
Just a collection of games
by a number of different developers.
Right.
And ever since, like, themes have come up, or developers like Capcom have decided to collect their games into bundles. But classically, there's no theme or single developer.
Right. So what will happen is they'll break it up into a tier list. Like, you can pay a minimum and get access to like 6 games, which then you own. And then you have the option of paying up, and the more that you're donating, which then you can also choose where your donations go, the more you donate, the more games you unlock. And it's usually the most you would spend on a Humble Bundle is in between $20 to $30.
Yeah.
And if you do go the full amount, you get probably closer to like 10 to 15 games, maybe, depending on, but I mean, that's the norm, I would think.
Yeah, it's a large amount.
Right. So Humble Bundle is essentially a game release aggregate, or whatever you want to call it. So a lot of people were saying that when IGN acquired this, that there would be a bias and that they would have say over what specific games were released, and I don't know. It seemed to be there was a lot of criticism involved. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, until fairly recently, Humble as a storefront was just a distribution center of sorts. Like, they just sold other people's games.
Right.
They recently started publishing too. They published A Hat in Time, which is a Nintendo 64 inspired 3D platformer that was a Kickstarter.
That game
was
cute.
A successful Kickstarter campaign.
It's a little cutie game.
Yeah. And they also published in the Humble Monthly collection a game from the developer of Quap called Getting Over It.
Oh, okay.
Which was just included in the Humble Monthly, and it's going to be released on Steam, I think, in like a month. So until recently, they were just a storefront. Now they're also publishing games.
Right. So there's could be a bias there then, if IGN is the ultimate owner of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you like IGN? Have you ever followed them? Do you believe that they're doing
a
good thing with what they do, the reviews and
Well, I started going to IGN when it was called IGN64.com, when it was just Nintendo 64
Yeah.
games. And it was great and had a lot of personality. And it was, for lack of a better word, scrappy. It has bloomed and ballooned into a massive media empire ever since its acquisition by Zap or something like that, a larger media company. And I don't go there anymore because the kind of coverage that they offer doesn't interest me. They mostly just cover, well, until, yeah, they mostly serve as like a source of press releases or like major reviews. But that's not the kind of thing that I'm looking for in games coverage any longer. So I'll go there to see what's up, see what's going on, but like I don't follow IGN
Right,
necessarily.
right.
What about you?
I don't either. I think that there might have been a time in years past where I would go on their channel or even their website just to look what's going on, because they'll usually have the biggest headlines. But there's other sites in, more independent sites that I prefer that do the same thing on a smaller scale, which is fine by me. The one thing I do use IGN for consistently is for tracking game release dates, mostly because when you just search on Google for upcoming game releases for Switch or whatever Xbox, that's like one of the first things that pops up. So that's probably the only time I'm on IGN lately.
So you were kind of leading this conversation in the direction of bias.
Yeah, I don't particularly have an opinion on that. I was just reading a lot of threads online about people who were saying that there was an extreme bias here for IGN being a site that like you said, in basically an empire that holds a lot of sway over what people think of games.
Yeah, I don't. So, in it's my experience that I don't really give a fuck about what IGN has to say about things.
Right.
Maybe that's like who I am or where I am in how I consume games media, but I just don't fucking care what IGN has to say about anything. And as to the whole notion of like really what we're talking about is quote unquote ethics in games journalism, right?
Right.
Like we're
Yeah.
talking about whether or not it's ethical for IGN to own a publisher, and whether or not those reviews would be ethical or valid. And my opinion is I don't fucking care. Like I don't care. It doesn't matter to me at all. I'm gonna watch a video or play a game on my own. A number has no impact on me whatsoever.
Yeah. No, I feel the
Anybody
same way.
cares
I agree.
about it? I just feel like people stress too much about this idea that games media has like enormous sway over their own, over like individual opinions or the finances of games publishing. I don't know why anybody gives a fuck. I just
Yeah.
don't understand that.
I mean, to be honest, I haven't watched a review or read a review with the idea in my mind that it was going to decide for me whether I played a game or not. I haven't done that in a really long time. That was something I kind of invested in as a younger person who maybe didn't really have a fully formed thought of what I believed to be good or what I enjoyed. So there was definitely a time, like with back in the Adam Sessler, Morgan Webb days, where I did watch reviews specifically to know if a game was good or not.
Well, look, like totally, man. Like, I completely subscribed to the notion that critics had, not critics, game reviewers, which is what this that sort of model of reviewing was at the time. Game reviewers had something to offer me that I otherwise was unable to obtain on my own. Like, I'm not going to be able to afford a $70 game on a whim. I'm going to have somebody tell me whether or not it's worth it.
Yes.
And also, like, coverage was much more limited. Like, I subscribed to GamePro. If I saw a review in GamePro, I trusted that review,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
that's not the way it is anymore. Like, if I see an IGN review, for example, of their own game, and it's a 9.0, and then everybody else has a 6.0 review, I'm going to understand.
You have your answer.
Yeah, like, and that doesn't bother me. I'll just trust everybody else. I'll trust the average and go with my gut.
Right. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave that. Probably could go on that topic, but we got to cover our Dreamcast stuff too. And that's very important.
Look, don't get me wrong, though. It's weird.
Yeah, it is a little weird.
I think realistically, IGN is understanding that they're not where people go anymore in the way that they used to be. So they're expanding their net for when their model fails eventually, which is going to.
Yeah, 100%.
Smart. So whatever.
There you go. Okay, so I guess we should get over to the old Dreamcast.
Can't hear it, but I'm making a shaka sound right now with my hand as I shake left and right because the Dreamcast is tight.
That was the boot up sound. It was just like a shaka, you know. It had a little. Did it have a? I don't remember the boot up sound. Did it have one?
Mm-hmm. It had like a. It went like.
God, I don't remember.
The thing drops into place and then it like spins and expands.
Was it GameCube? Because GameCube had that like classic boot up.
No, it was very shimmery and light.
Okay.
Yeah, it was cool. It was the whole Dreamcast thing was like dreamy.
And, right. Very light. Very
light.
Otherworldly.
Yeah. So when did you get yours?
It's hard to remember, you know. We discussed wanting to do this and talk about it, and I spent a lot of time trying to remember exactly my history with it, because I did have one, and I did get one not long after launch. Mm-hmm. I would say within 3 months, you know, and I was pretty young when it came out. How old were you when it came out? Do you remember?
I was 15.
So I must have been probably in between 10 and 11, maybe 12 or something when this came out. And you know, I don't even, you know, obviously I didn't buy it myself. It was a gift for a holiday or just because, you know, I got lucky with it. Mm-hmm. Definitely probably a grandma purchase. And I think the first game I got for it was Sonic. Sonic Adventure. And totally. And then Crazy Taxi, those were the first two.
Hell yeah, dude. Yeah, I got the Dreamcast for my birthday, which was a couple weeks after the release of it, and just birthday night I just played it until like 6 a.m. just yes. Fucking petting some chows, baby.
Yes. You get yours with a memory card with the VMU?
I think so, yeah.
Because I didn't have one for like 6 months.
How did you play that game?
What I had to do literally for the first 6 months is when I would play Sonic Adventure and I would, and I felt like I had got decently far, I just wouldn't turn my Dreamcast off. And every time I did, I lost everything.
That sucks ass.
Yeah, and I had to do the same with because one of the games I got pretty early on too is Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Mm-hmm. And to have that game in my house was a huge deal for me.
Did you play it at the arcade or something?
Yeah, like religiously.
Oh, really?
Yeah, me and my brother for at least one summer and then a few months, we would walk to the movie theater a few times a week because they had one in the theater. And we would just load up probably like 10 bucks each on quarters and just go round for round.
How the fuck did you and I never post up on MVC2? Because I was a major MVC2 player.
I think, didn't we? I thought we did.
Did we post up?
I think we did at one point. We played it on the 360 at one point.
What's your team?
I usually played kind of like a... Well, I liked using Gambit, Cyclops, and Cable.
Those were my, that's a wild team.
Yeah. I liked Gambit a lot, and he was kind of like not... used that often. He was like the under tier, you know. God tier is like Wolverine, Cable's like a pretty common one. Magneto, Sentinel. Those are like the top choices, but
those are good choices.
Yeah. What was your team?
I was like Bone Claw, Wolverine, Akira, and I like June, I believe was his name.
Oh, the guy in the white, all white outfit that would spin. Yeah. He had like tornado
arm.
It's right. That's right. Oh, you know who also was good was Captain Commando in that game. That's his name,
Captain
right?
Captain Commando's really good, yeah.
That was a good game.
So I love that game so much that I fucking downloaded the disc image and swapped out all the music with my own music files. So like when you booted it up, it started playing Rage Against the Machine's Wake Up.
So you did this on the Dreamcast?
No, on the Xbox.
Oh, okay, on the Xbox. Got it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
The
Dreamcast. Well, I didn't have the VMU, which was an important part of owning a Dreamcast, is you need to be able to save your games. Yeah. And the VMU fit into your controller. And I guess that's a good segue into what the controller is.
It's the ugliest piece of crap in the world.
Yeah. I think it was a precursor to the Xbox controller in a lot of ways, the original Xbox controller. It's just like this super fat, wide brick that you would hold. Mm-hmm. And the Dreamcast controller had a slot that would come in from the top and take the place of the top middle of it, which is where you would plug in your VMU, which is video memory unit, right? Is that what it stands for? Yeah. And it had a little tiny LCD screen. Or is it LED?
It was an LCD.
LCD, right. And that would show you little messages and tell you things about the game you're playing. I think it was pretty helpful with the Sonic Adventure games, right? Because I think you had this mini game with the Chao Garden shit involved.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't helpful so much as contrived. Or not contrived, but like... It seemed like it was created with the purpose of using the VMU, like a Tamagotchi. But the real application while playing was like specifically in sports games, you could choose your play on your VMU so that your buddies couldn't see what you were gonna do.
Right.
Yeah, the VMU was fucking tight though. I remember bringing that thing to school and playing Snake in gym class.
Oh no!
Keeping that bad boy in my pocket.
Bad boy. Did you have one that was like a cool color? Or did you have the classic?
I just had a white one.
Because they had started making them like in like see through blue.
Yeah.
Which was like if you had the see through blue one, like the crystal blue one, you were set. Like everyone wanted to be your friend because that was the coolest one. The orange one is pretty cool too.
Yeah, that was a weird invention, man. I admire that so much about that whole thing was weird.
Yeah, I think that when people look back now on the Dreamcast in totality, a lot of feelings start with, man, that was weird. You know, like, oh, what a weird thing. But the Dreamcast was a big innovator in like many ways. And there's so much that we can't get bogged down. So I think a good idea would just to cover like some of the top innovations, you know. And I don't even know if we've mentioned that this was Sega's last console.
Yeah, I mean, Sega pulled a Nintendo and like went above and beyond what was required of them in a way that the market wasn't prepared for, and unlike Nintendo, they just fucking bailed when it didn't work. Like they put that thing down short of 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
I don't even think it made it to the second year.
And I think it was just shy of the 2 year mark.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's crazy. And I mean, when you look at it, like to have a console of that magnitude, one that had games on it that were upwards of 70 million to make, Shinmu, to know that its life cycle was that short. But then if you put it in the perspective of like, there were still being like Dreamcast sold at retail as late as 2007 in Japan.
That's weird.
Yeah, which is like, where did they even come from? Had they not already been sold if they only produced them for 2 years? And these were like new from Sega, you know.
I would have picked one of those.
Right.
I had no
totally.
That. So the thing about the Dreamcast that makes it unique to me is it has this like super specific of its time and of its place, like je ne sais quoi about it that is just like not in any other console, not in anything else, really. Like it has a specific color palette, it has a specific feeling. Many of its games have a specific attitude. There's a specific energy. And I think all of it is related to the hardware and also like the type of thing that Japanese developers were doing at the time, which is not what they're doing anymore.
I agree. And for me, the way this felt for me is that it was the first time, and there's obviously previous examples of this, like the Neo Geos is a good example, which came out before this, but it was the first time I was able to play arcade games at home. There's other examples of it, sure, like Sunset Riders was a game I played endlessly in the arcade, and it was a Super Nintendo game. But not of this quality of game. Like the game I think I played the most on Sega Dreamcast, besides Power Stone, was a game called Dynamite Cop. And that is sort of like a, in the same vein as those Die Hard games that were in the
Die
arcade.
Hard Arcade.
Or like Fighting Force, which it's like a 3D brawler. And I just loved that game in the arcade, and I
So
never
good.
could dream I would play it at home. And
Well,
there I was.
the reason that so much of the art, like Japanese Sega published arcade games were coming out on the Dreamcast is because, to my understanding, the hardware in the Dreamcast is identical, or if not completely identical, very, very close to identical to the Naomi board, which is what was used in premier Sega games like Daytona USA. And
And Dreamcast was the first 128-bit console.
when bits mattered. I think it was the last console in which bits
I
mattered.
think so, yeah.
But yeah, you had the Dreamcast, or you had a Daytona USA, you had Crazy Taxi, you had Dynamite Cop, you had Outrigger, you had MVC2. It was loaded with arcade
Yeah, it
games.
really was. And that's a big deal for people who were used to not being able to play, you know, unless in Neo Geo shit was so expensive to get in America.
Yeah, totally.
So to have the ease of availability of like premier arcade titles at home is a big deal. Very big deal.
I think that the like arcade ethos of like bright colors, loud music, brief experiences, high energy. I think all of that found its way into Dreamcast games, even when they weren't arcade games. You'd still see that and still feel it. Like even in like a game like Jet Set Radio, which is like the quintessential Dreamcast game in every way. Never an arcade experience, but the playing experience of like a round in that game is very similar to something like Daytona USA
Yeah, for sure.
or
I mean, and
whatever.
even I think this came up recently when we were doing a podcast or something, I don't remember, but in Crazy Taxi, there is the guy at the main menu saying, "Hey, get over here," or whatever, which is directly from the
Hey,
arcade
come on over
version.
here and have some fun with Crazy Taxi.
He's calling you over.
Yeah, he's literally he's beckoning you.
It's there.
What's that called? I forget what that's called. Anyway.
Anyway. Okay, so great games had a pretty big library. A lot of Japanese imports that actually made it to America, which was cool because Sega was allowing that and saying, "Hey, like, why not give it a shot? Bring them over here. See if anyone bites."
It's called attract mode. I
Exactly.
remember now. Attract mode.
Attract mode. And that's what Sega was doing. But yeah, they had a ton of wacky, weird games right off the bat. I think did that game Seaman, was that a launch game?
Nah, that wasn't a launch game, but it was I think it was mid-cycle.
Okay.
It was a weird that's the weirdest
That's probably the
game.
weirdest Dreamcast game and one that a lot of people tie into it. I know that when I bring it up with people who lived through that era or had one, they always find themselves talking about Seaman because it's just such a wacky game. And the variety was there for sure on the Dreamcast. Personal experience of mine is that throughout the time I had a Dreamcast, mine was actually stolen after having it for probably less than a year, and then I never got one again. And I didn't, so I never owned that many games for it. I think Sonic Adventure, Crazy Taxi, Power Stone are like the top, and the Marvel vs. Capcom 2. But, you know, I would still go and rent Blockbuster games, but obviously this was a time when I couldn't just go out and buy a game if I wanted one. So I had to really pick and choose. But the variety was insane, so it was always super hard for me to go down to the store and pick one because there's games like Seaman littering the aisles. And people were just like going nuts.
A fully Japanese console, so it had lots of, like, it had lots of games that used concepts and gameplay models that were like largely untouched by Western developers. So lots of weird stuff. Like, I remember I was big on a game called Tokyo Extreme Racer, which was a racing game where you are like a dude driving imports around the Japanese freeways. But there's no like stopping point. You're just driving on this freeway, and to get in a race, you find another dude in a gnarly import and you flash your high beams at him.
Oh, really?
And then, yeah, and then if he's into it, he'll just start fucking tearing ass.
That's great.
And the racing, like, win state is when you get a far enough distance between you and him. And then they just give up. Because they're like, all right, fuck. Because that's, like, how a real freeway race works.
Yeah, it's, like, totally reality sim with street racing there.
It was tight. That is cool. Virtua Tennis, still one of the strongest tennis games of all time.
It's so good.
There's something about like the perfect match of the crispness of the hardware, like the crispness of the polygons with the color palette that it allowed and the simplicity of the textures that were that the hardware like limited you to that resulted in the specific look of Dreamcast games that I just like, it's like timeless.
Yeah.
Like looking at Virtua Tennis, like the faces in those dudes are ugly as fuck, but like it's still pretty. That game is still real nice looking.
Yeah, going back and like playing Dead or Alive or something on Dreamcast is an absolute treat for the eyes.
Soul Calibur popping on Kalik, putting on his like demo. He's just playing the stick around. I'm all about that.
Oh, it's so good. So I was gonna ask you, how long did you have one for? Did you have one?
I still have it.
Oh, so you still have yours?
Yeah, I still have the original.
Wow. So in the time, you know, the few years or however long that you spent playing it, did you have any online experiences?
I never played any games proper online. I probably played Choo Choo Rocket against somebody once or twice. It was a weird puzzle game, but like my online experience was pretty much exclusively relegated to getting free internet through Net Zero and signing in using the browser, the Dreamcast browser, and its shitty 56K modem.
Yep.
And watching porn pictures load over the course of like 10 minutes.
Oh man, I can only imagine how many Dreamcasts were put to use in that way.
That was life changing. Well, because like the other thing, well, I'm gonna stick with life changing. But the other thing is that you have to. In order to use the internet on the Dreamcast, you had to like sign up for their service and pay like a monthly fee. But there was this loophole where you could use Net Zero on it instead. And for like anyone unfamiliar, Net Zero was one of a couple of advertisement based ISP systems where like you don't pay for your internet service. They just show you ads everywhere instead.
Yeah.
And so I like signed up on to Net Zero on my browser, and then I went on to Dreamcast and logged into that shit.
Fuck.
And yeah, that was my first like major like hacking experience.
Right. So I totally missed the boat on that. It was a little bit before I even used the internet.
I think around that time is, you know, 11, 12 was about when I first even had my first like AIM account. So that was, you know, I don't even know if I were, if I knew at that time that the Dreamcast could do that. I have no memory of trying to access the internet through it or even realizing that you could play games online with other people.
That was at the cusp of my like coming to understand. That was at the cusp. Fuck. Yeah, that was at the cusp of my understanding the internet to be like, oh, I can do like secret things on this thing.
Right.
And
like you found yourself in the fucking dark web on accident.
Dude, yeah, like I was in some Counter-Strike server. Tor. And some dude was like, hey man, like I'm downloading RARs for Freedom Force right now. I'm like, what's a RAR?
Oh man. So because the Dreamcast famously, notoriously, was easily, like, the games were super easy to pirate. Probably the first home console that experienced that much piracy and that much quote unquote like hacking of things. Did you ever get involved in that besides your little internet trick? Did you ever?
Sort of. So like the interesting thing about this is that the Saturn is infamous for having one of the most difficult to pirate copy protection methods. The disks themselves had physical like waves around the rim of the disk. Like it looks like a little ripple going around the entire rim of the disk, and if the laser doesn't see that, it's like, all right, well, not a real game. And you can't fake that. Like you can't just draw a ripple onto your disk. So that was like an extremely effective copy protection method, because nobody produces discs like that. And then Sega moved to the GD-ROM, which is a disc that can hold a gigabyte of data, versus like typical 700 megs. 700 megs. I think that they expected the like unusual format to be a limiting factor, but it just wasn't, because you could burn DVDs already. Another element was, like, I don't remember if this was true or not, but maybe people didn't have DVD burners very often at the time.
I think they just completely underestimated the will of the people to pirate their games.
Yeah, and so like my dad like worked in computers, so he had all kinds of shit. Like the first time I actually played a Dreamcast was at my dad's work, because one of his employees, her husband worked for Sega at the time, and he brought in the Dreamcast, and I played Sonic in like June of '99. And interesting side note, in the Japanese version of Sonic Adventure, you could get hit by the cars.
And it would hurt you, right?
Yeah, it would hurt you. But in the American version,
they screech to a halt. I remember those screeching tires. They're burned into my memory.
It's horrible.
Yeah. Because not only did the tires screech on the cars, but Sonic's shoes would make that screech whenever you stopped. Like, and you're not even running. You're just walking. You turn around too quickly.
Yeah, it's like Converse on parquet.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, yeah, so he got the hookup and brought home some weird Dreamcast games one day on like sick DVDs.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of them was Darkstalkers, which is a good ass fighting game.
Yeah.
Another one was this weird 3D fighting game. I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't very good. And I think those are the ones that stick out in my memory.
Right, right.
Yeah. Or what was your favorite Dreamcast game, Julian?
I think the one I probably spent the most time with was Marvel's Capcom 2. That game was a big deal for me and my brother and some of my friends. That was a game that we played endlessly. And, you know, as I mentioned at the top of this cast, was that I didn't have a VMBU for a while. It was something I got later, and then my whole shit got stolen anyway. But
you got taken for a ride.
I did. It was an emotional ride. With Marvel vs. Capcom 2, you had to unlock characters, right from the beginning, you know, for the console versions.
Oh.
Like in the arcade version, you go there and obviously all the characters are already unlocked.
Yeah.
But on the console versions, at least with the Dreamcast, I think in later re-releases of it, they just said fuck it and gave you everything right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But in the Dreamcast version, at least, you had to accrue points by playing the game, and then you would spend those to unlock your characters. Mm-hmm. And then, provided you have a VMU, once you unlock your characters, you don't need to worry about it. You have them already. But for me, I didn't have that. So what my loophole that I created was, is that you could go in that game, you can go into practice mode and set it to, like, just have your character there with the other practice dummy, whatever. And how you accrued points in that is just the more you played it, the more you accrued points. So mm-hmm. I just put it on practice mode, leave it on overnight. When I'd wake up in the morning, I'd have like a million points, enough to unlock every character.
Okay.
And even then, like the character, how you unlock them, it was random. Like you kind of, it was like a card system or something. You had to get lucky. Anyway, probably Marvel's Capcom 2, I'd say. And then close seconds would be Power Stone 2, and Dynamite Cop, and maybe House of the Dead 2. I played a lot with the light
gun. Good choices. You had a light gun for it, too?
I did. I got it. Wow. A friend got me one for my birthday. Well, his parents, essentially. But yeah, I had a light gun in House of the Dead 2, and that was fantastic.
Nice.
What was yours?
Number one, with a spray can, was Jet Set Radio.
Yep.
Absolutely. I played the shit out of that game. I would come home senior year of high school.
Uh-oh. If for all those out there, that is the universal sound of a doobie being spliffed on.
Oh, cheap one. Cheap a little bit. And then I would fucking literally, I would sit in a beanbag chair with headphones on and just jam out to Hideki Naganuma's like sick ass tunes. Dude,
it's so good still. It's so good. It's one of the best.
Oh man. Yeah. He was incredible, dude. And then he like even improved on with Jet Set Radio Future, but we're not even going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. I fucking played the shit out of that game all the time. Just a perfect zone out game. Beautiful. Just incredible aesthetic, like aesthetic first mm-hmm. of all. The game is designed aesthetic first, and like it has a number of gameplay weaknesses that just don't fucking matter at all because like being in that game is so tight.
Yeah.
I played that game a lot. Power Stone games. Another like hidden gem was San Francisco Rush 2049. Did you ever play that?
I don't think so.
Did you ever play any of the San Francisco Rush games?
Potentially on the N64, maybe. I mean, that name sounds familiar, yeah. But
yeah. So the San Francisco Rush series was a racing series. It started as an arcade racer, and the tracks were just like enormous, and they had like wild shortcuts in them that were extremely dangerous because like any crash would just blow your whole fucking car up,
yeah,
and set you back, and the games got increasingly like fixated on the shortcut element, and Rush 2049 was the fourth iteration at this point. There was Rush 2, there was Rush the Rock, and then Rush 2, which was a console exclusive, and then Rush 2049. And 2049 is the future, obviously, and your car has fucking wings that serve no purpose other than to like allow you to control it to do flips and shit.
Oh, what?
Like, it's not a strategic function at all. It's just for cool shit.
Yeah.
And the courses have, like, buttons on them that you can flip to, like, make the course, like, open up and do weird shit. And on the console versions, the courses also have, like, Easter eggs hidden all over the course where, like, you would go, like, backwards and drive real slow to, like, fall down a little thing. And down there would be, like, a little thing you'd collect.
Right.
It's just awesome. Yeah. Like it introduced like a 3D platforming element to the console.
I didn't play that, but the game I played that is very similar to that in a lot of ways, because this reminded me of it with the secret areas and that would change things up severely or drastically, I mean, was mm-hmm. Hydro Thunder.
Oh yeah,
Hydro Thunder was similar in a lot of that, like just
yeah
had a lot of secret areas that you could access.
And that was the best looking version of the game at the time too.
Yeah, for sure.
Which was a big deal about those water physics, maybe.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. I wonder, do you know how much Dreamcast costs nowadays? What it would be to pick one up?
Like 70 bucks, probably. 70, yeah. 80 bucks.
That's generally like what you're going to pay for any of the, like, a refurbished console, N64 or Dreamcast.
Yeah.
Usually going to be around 60, 70 bucks.
And then my other favorite was Crazy Taxi. I played the shit out of Crazy Taxi.
Yeah.
That game introduced me to Bad Religion. I was already familiar with Offspring, but now Bad Religion is one of my favorite bands.
What was the song that they used in that?
They used 10 and 2010 for Bad Religion, from Bad Religion, which is about 10 billion people on Earth by the year 2010. And then they used two Offspring songs. I can't remember the names of these fucking songs.
I don't even know if it matters. Probably not.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. There were literally four songs in that game, though. Two Offspring songs and two Bad Religion songs.
They must have liked those two bands then.
Yeah, man. And then in the re-release, they only licensed to the Offspring song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stuff, you know? A lot of in my head built up over the years. A lot of Dreamcast memories. There's a lot of people, so I think, from around our age.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know. You'd probably be surprised how few people actually own that console.
Yeah, that's also true. Or
maybe
you
wouldn't.
I don't know. Well, if you think about it, if you look at the numbers of how many have sold since then, and I mean, they made like just in the 2 years, I think they made almost 700 games. Like there was just a lot happening in between 99 and 2001.
Just Western adaptation or Western adoption of that console was poor.
Yeah.
Like straight up. And also, it was expensive. And it was also like an exclusive kind of console. Like it was, at the time, there was the Nintendo 64 and
the PlayStation,
which were both consoles out of step with each other, but were in effect directly competing with one another. And then the Dreamcast comes forward and is like, I'm twice as expensive, but I'm also hugely powerful and extremely Japanese.
Have internet.
I have the internet, but like it already has limited its audience by finances and by like aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then the PlayStation 2 came out shortly thereafter and just fucking crushed.
100%. So. I think that at that time, you know, I don't know if Western culture was appropriating Japanese culture like it does now, you know, with the amount of influence that anime and manga has had in the past just 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't. I think that's definitely in part. You know, Dreamcast wasn't as successful. I don't think the Western world was wanting to adopt Japanese things.
No, then. Western games interests were not leaning in this direction. There was so much joy in, I mean, like, it says a lot about our culture. But there was so much joy in Japanese games that was totally absent from Western games that. Obviously, Western game players were not interested in the vibrancy and the like fervor around these games was was the opposite of Western game development at the time.
Mm-hmm. And it was still, I mean, if you look, just look at the Nintendo games that come out compared to the games that come out on Xbox and PS4. I mean, strictly speaking, console wise. Like 9 times out of 10, when you see a new Nintendo release, it's going to be bright, colorful, childlike, imaginative, playful. And then you look at Call of Duty or any of these other darker games, or the Western games that come out on the other two. So,
yeah, I think that that's reflective of the shifting market, like. At the time, Japanese game developers were developing for their Japanese audiences because they were huge. Like, games were still being played on consoles in Japan. And so they didn't need Western audiences. And now you can look to games like From Software, Dark Souls games that take influence from Western games And we'll say as much, the developers will announce, or like Resident Evil 4, they'll say as much, like, we admire Western developers, we admire what Western developers are doing, here's our take on that, or mm-hmm. we'll incorporate these elements of it, whereas previously it was at best the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. But
now people in Japan don't play games on consoles anymore, so
all about Hearthstone and League of Legends and Overwatch
and cell phone games.
So, oh yeah, mobile games are the killer.
Big up on the cell phone games.
Yeah.
Dreamcast, dude.